If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
So when the head of the CIA was asked at the beginning of the 21st century to summarize what they did, he only required three words, and the three words were, "We steal secrets."
That was Christopher Andrew discussing the history of intelligence.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Today's podcast guest is a world-renowned historian of intelligence and espionage, Professor Christopher Andrew, whose previous books include The Authorised History of MI5 and A History of KGB Activities in the West. His latest book, The Secret World, A History of Intelligence, has just been released, and our staff writer Ellie Cawthorne met up with him recently to find out more.
So today on the podcast, I'm joined by Professor Christopher Andrew, who's spent the last 50 years working on the history of intelligence and espionage, during which time you've been the official historian of MI5, and you've also worked in secret with KGB agents. This summer, of course, you've got a new book out. I wonder whether you could maybe just give us a little introduction, a taster to what's in store.
Absolutely. I mean, the reason that I began in the first place was not because I was exceptionally interested in spies and code-breaking and so on, but because it just got left out of other histories. So, you know, most, for example, students at university are now in the extraordinary position, on the front pages of their newspapers, they're going to read spy stories, and then when they get set essays in IR or history or whatever, they're not going to be any. So anyway, what this book is intended to do is plug that that sort of gap. And what it's forced me to do for the first time is go right back to the beginning. So the first person of any significance in world literature who insisted on the importance of accurate intelligence was God, who, when he decided to hand over to the children of Israel the promised land, told Moses to send out spies to spy out the promised land, the land of Canaan. Moses messed it up, and that was the first real intelligence failure, and there have been quite a few since.
I think, actually, I should mention that the name of your book is The Secret World, A History of Intelligence. And as you mentioned, you start with the Bible, and you take things right up to the 21st century. What do we gain from such a broad spectrum of intelligence history, rather than just focusing on the 20th century, as is often done?
Well, two things. One is the missing bit, because you can look up most histories of most parts of the world at most periods, at any rate up to the 21st century, and it's missing. Secondly, we get a better insight, I think, into what's gone wrong in the 21st century, because this is an area in which the intelligence profession, not its own fault, has been more ignorant of past experience than any other. I mean, even Bletchley Park, you know, the one British intelligence agency, which is world famous and now a tourist site where we broke Hitler's ciphers and so on. The people there had the slightest idea that they weren't the first to do this. You know, the previous time where we were facing a likely invasion from Napoleon, we broke his code. Bletchley didn't know that. And the people who broke Napoleon's code at the beginning of the 19th century, they had no idea. That the last time we were threatened with a really nasty invasion, which was called the Spanish Armada, Philip II's codes were broken as well. So the missing bit is put back a hope into a significant amount of British and world history.
Intelligence over this time has taken so many different forms. I wonder whether you could tell us what exactly we are talking about when we're talking about intelligence.
I mean, the basis of intelligence, which has got lots of complicated definitions, most of the complicated definitions seem to me to be pointless. It's just secrets, what you can't get from open sources. So when the head of the CIA was asked at the beginning of the 21st century to summarize what they did, he only required three words, and the three words were, "We steal secrets." Now, that sounds pretty obvious, but understanding secrets is not very straightforward. And the reason is that most people get their idea of intelligence not from books, which until recently were not written anyway, but from spy fiction. Intelligence is far better known at a fictional level than a factual level. And you know, one of the main distortions is simply this. Anyone who works with information, which is everybody, knows that it really comes in one sensational piece of information. You just pick it up all the time and gradually make your mind up. But in spy stories, it's the other way around. You don't bother about everyday stuff. You suddenly get a shattering piece of information, and it's not like that at all.
Something that you discuss throughout the book is SIGINT.
Yes.
Which, for us civilians, could you explain what exactly that is and why it has been so important in the history of intelligence?
Well, I'm glad to be able to do so, because even the word was classified until 50 years ago. SIGINT stands for Signals Intelligence. But what it actually means is the information you pick up from intercepting communications, which has been going on for as long as there were communications. And that is, of course, what Bletchley Park did so brilliantly during the Second World War. But the point the book makes is that it's been going on for ages and ages. Now, the Europeans, the West, weren't the best at it until the 16th century. The first people to be really good at it was the House of Wisdom, the Muslim House of Wisdom in 9th century Baghdad. And the man who made the biggest breakthrough in the history of code breaking was a man called Al-Kindi. Now, when Renaissance Venice made exactly the same breakthrough in the early 16th century, it hadn't the slightest idea that the same breakthrough had been made 600 years earlier by Muslim cryptanalysts. So that's a continuous part of the history of international relations, forgotten by most historians of international relations. And even as recently as the Cold War, for example, most people would probably say that the best single volume history of the Cold War, not quite most up to date any longer, is by John Gaddis, and it's called The Cold War. There is not one word about code breaking in that. So nobody, not even a student, would write about the Second World War without mentioning intelligence. People carry on writing about the Cold War as if SIGINT didn't exist.
So, of course, we've mentioned that you think intelligence is often missing from the picture of history. But as a historian, how do you go about finding and uncovering something that is inherently covert and inherently hidden?
Well, like a lot of historical research, it's really, really difficult and therefore more enjoyable. But some of it is utterly straightforward. It's simply that people haven't paid attention to it. So that under Queen Elizabeth I, intelligence was just as important as it's been under Queen Elizabeth II. Indeed, Queen Elizabeth was in serious danger of assassination. And the only way these assassination plots could be discovered was actually by intelligence of various kinds. Now, all that material is there. What has not been noticed is how grateful Queen Elizabeth was. Queen Elizabeth not merely sent her personal congratulations to the codebreaker who discovered one of the major plots, she also gave him a pension. And she saw her intelligence chief every day. There's no other monarch who has seen her or his intelligence chief every day since then. This was Francis Walsingham. And she gave him a picture as a sign of gratitude, which has got all the Tudors on it. But what I think is most extraordinary, and a clue that's been missed until very recently, is her royal frock. Against strong competition, the most extraordinary royal frock in the entire history of British royal frocks is Queen Elizabeth I's last frock. Now, it's in a painting, but she had to give her personal approval, so we know that she personally approved it, a year or so before her death in 1603. And what does it show? The dress is covered by a cloak which has two motifs on it, which cover the whole cloak, eyes and ears. What do they mean? Don't even think about it, traitors. My boys, and this was not an equal opportunity profession, can hear everything you say and see everything you do. So that frock has been there for about 500 years. But what has happened is that they're historians of frocks and they're historians of secret intelligence. And until I and one or two others came along, they've not got together.
I think that raises an interesting point about the way that intelligence has been used. And in another part of the book, you speak about Ivan the Terrible and Stalin, kind of drawing parallels between the two and the very intense security services that they employed. Do you think that intelligence is a sign of strength in a state or a sign of weakness because you feel the paranoia and the need to spy on everyone?
Well, first of all, it's essential. But how authoritarian states and relatively democratic states use it is really rather different. Why is it essential? Well, you know, as with crime, you can do one of two things. You can wait until you're burgled and then investigate it, or you can try and work out beforehand where the threat is coming from. Now, it's exactly the same with terrorism and with the origins of the Second World War. What do you wait? Do you wait for somebody to declare war? Do you wait for a terrorist atrocity? Or do you try and work it out beforehand? Well, the difference between that, however, and the way that Ivan the Terrible and Stalin used it is very different. What Ivan the Terrible did was use it to exterminate not merely all his opponents, but everyone he thought might be one of his opponents, most of whom weren't. And that's what Stalin did. And that is why one of the things that Stalin did when he came to power was to ask the greatest filmmaker of the age, Eisenstein, to make a film on Ivan the Terrible and to show that the purges and the killings which Ivan the Terrible had been responsible for were actually essential to the survival of the Russian state, which they weren't. And that's what Stalin said about his own purges, and they weren't necessary then either.
This may be a completely impossible question, but can you identify a golden age of spying? So what I mean by that is possibly when spying was most useful or most impactful.
Well, now might be one moment. Of course, there are a number of different answers. But what I think now is a turning point in the history of terrorism. You know, terrorism is not something which we should be continuously terrified of. But one of two things is going to happen, that we will continue to get terrorists who use really rather old-fashioned methods, bombs, even if they themselves are suicide bombers, and even mow people down with trucks. The other thing is that they will move to weapons of mass destruction. And that is what most dangerous terrorist in modern history, Osama bin Laden, wanted to do. I mean, he said a few years before 9/11 that that wasn't his ultimate aim. His ultimate aim was to use weapons of mass destruction. Furthermore, he described it as a religious duty. So, you know, one of the few constants in human history, well, I think there are about two. One is human nature. So, you know, there's still going to be people who are so self-righteous that they believe they have the right to impose their views on everybody else. Secondly, is that all human inventions, without any exception and without any possible exception, spread around the world. Now, it used to happen really rather slowly. Now it happens really rather quickly. To believe that terrorists are not going to use weapons of mass destruction, you would have to believe that for the first time in human history, there was a human invention which did not proliferate. That ain't going to happen.
Which really taps into the central message of your book, I think, which is that if we don't look at the intelligence of the past, how can we shape the intelligence of the future?
Absolutely. And some of the messages are utterly straightforward. But of course, there are a lot of people who just think of long-term past experience as history. You know, the kind of thing that we had to take at school and possibly took at university and really don't want to touch again for the rest of their lives. Now, that's simple nonsense, and it's not difficult to point to really elementary errors. So I'll just pick one. The most important interrogation of the 21st century so far was of Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein was finally caught in December 2003, after he'd lost the war in Iraq. And so there he was, waiting to be interrogated. Now, the preparations and the use of intelligence to do so were not in the same class as they'd been at the end of the Second World War. Well, Hitler committed suicide, so he wasn't around, but his number two, Goering, was around. And even nowadays, if one looks at the interrogation, it's very difficult to see how it could have been very much better. Now, when Saddam Hussein was caught, there were no preparations, by which I mean none at all. They didn't even have, for a couple of months, an Arabic speaker to question him. And there were elementary mistakes made at the very beginning. So the lesson we can draw from all this is that intelligence, in more than in any other area of human activity, is not linear. In other words, you can't assume that one generation will have learnt from the previous generation and therefore be a bit better. Now, just one example. A couple of people that everyone who does international relations in the 20th century, anyone who does history in the 20th century, and others will have come across. The British Prime Minister at the outbreak of World War I, Herbert Asquith. Very well educated, got a good first class honours at Oxford and a prize fellowship, and his American counterpart, President Woodrow Wilson. Probably the best educated president in American history. He was the former president of a major university. Now, these people, as my book shows, and I don't think it's controversial, were not in the same class as their 18th century predecessors. Woodrow Wilson was not remotely as good as George Washington. Asquith was not remotely as good as Pitt the Younger and Pitt the Elder. Now, if people working on intelligence were aware just how much worse people could be than people who were doing a similar job 100 years ago. Well, as I've said, they're not aware quite often. It's a bit like talking to economists who have never heard of the Industrial Revolution.
Something I found really interesting was your suggestion about ideology and that when we saw the rise of extremist Islamist terrorism, that the security services weren't prepared to grapple with the ideology and they didn't understand the consequences of that.
That's something which at the end of the 20th century we were worse at than we had been during the Cold War, and we were worse at than we had been during the Second World War. And the reason is utterly straightforward. People in intelligence services knew about Nazi fascist ideology. People in the Cold War knew about communist ideology in its Stalinist form, amongst others. But the problem about Islamist extremism is that this is religious extremism. And what you need to understand that is not political scientists. You need theologians. And it never occurred, as far as I'm aware, to any intelligence service in the late 20th century that they should hire theologians, but they should have done. So understanding Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and for that matter, Islamic State, without understanding their theology is a bit like attempting to understand Stalin without knowing about communism, and a bit like attempting to understand Hitler without bothering to read Mein Kampf.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings, that frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest, whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it, so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Already we've mentioned a lot of famous faces here, but who are some of the slightly more shadowy characters that we may not have heard of that captured your imagination when you were researching the book?
Well, one of them, I don't think it's a shadowy character, but a good example of somebody whose name is universally known but virtually never thought of in the context of intelligence is Muhammad. No disrespect intended at all to Muhammad. But non-Muslims have a very feeble understanding of the Quran and what is in the Quran. So far as Muhammad is concerned, those biographies of Muhammad that are most widely read by Muslims in England and elsewhere, I'm thinking of the single most popular one, very good one in many ways, describe him as the greatest general in the world. Now, if the account in the Quran is to be believed, which all Muslims believe is to be believed, then that's absolutely right. He won all 27 battles that he fought, and he was engaged in lots of smaller conflicts. And one of the things that he used, as any good general would have done, was military intelligence. So the idea that there is an intelligence dimension to the life of Muhammad, I think would surprise most people. All the way through ancient and modern history, if you take into account the intelligence dimension, it doesn't necessarily involve discovering new spies, new code breakers, but it may well give you an insight you wouldn't get if you weren't interested in intelligence.
Of course, intelligence has been used for military purposes, as you mentioned. And what I found interesting in your book was the suggestion that those who we think of from history as amazing military figures, Napoleon and also the Roman army, famously both great at warfare, but you suggest that maybe they were actually quite weak at intelligence and let down by that side of things.
Yes, the only area of thought and practice that I can think of in which the Romans were simply not in the same class as Asians, Chinese and Indians come to mind, but not they're the only ones, is intelligence. Because the Romans won, essentially, because they were the best organized, they had the biggest and best army, and so on. But they won despite their use of intelligence, and not because of their use of intelligence. So here was the problem. And it's something that has changed in a way that I think Roman historians have not usually realized by Constantine's conversion to Christianity. What they paid attention to was what the gods told them they should do. How do you know what the gods are telling you? Divination. And different kinds of divination, you know, you study the movement of birds as if you would discover anything useful that way. But more frequently than not, by actually sacrificing animals and looking at their liver. And according to the shape of the liver, well, you knew various other things. I mean, it was so ridiculous that Russian generals were supposed to take coops of chickens on campaign with them. So before your battle, you were supposed, I'm not making any of this up, you let the chickens out, you give them some corn. If they're not interested, that is really bad news because it shows you haven't any chance of winning. But there are other things they can do. What a lot of wasted time. So from the moment that Constantine, the Emperor Constantine, becomes Christian, I would like to think that Roman generals heave a sigh of relief saying, oh, thank God, we needn't look at the livers of sacrificed animals any longer. We needn't take those wretched chickens on campaign any longer. We can use spies instead. Well, it doesn't happen overnight, but that is a real turning point in the history of intelligence.
What were some of the turning points in terms of intelligence thought and writing? You talk about the art of war, and I wonder whether you could explain some of the key principles in that and how it was so significant.
Yeah, well, what nobody knows how to pronounce his name correctly in their English, and I'm certainly not going to do it, but the individual known in to English speakers as Sun Tzu, who was a Chinese general, a contemporary of Confucius. His is the oldest book on intelligence to survive, and it's still taught, not simply in Asian military colleges, but at West Point and Western ones as well. And the key point is essentially that intelligence is essential. You know, he exaggerates. He says, you know, if you understand yourself and you understand the enemy, then you can't lose. Well, actually, you can, because even if you know more than the enemy, if they have a bigger army than you, that's going to make a bigger difference. But he's the first person to spell that simple truth out. Nobody in Roman history did it. Nobody in Greek history did it. It took us an awful long time to arrive at that conclusion. What one can see in 19th, 20th century and for that matter, other centuries, however, is the best generals in most respects not winning in the end because they ignored intelligence. Now, Napoleon is a good example. There's not much doubt that he was the best general on the battlefield at the end of the 18th century in the later Revolutionary Wars and also in the Napoleonic Wars. But he didn't know his limitations. So, you know, went off to conquer Russia. And their intelligence was far better than his. They saw him coming, and it was an extraordinary achievement to get out alive. The same happened in the so-called Peninsular War, Wellington's and other British generals campaigned against him in Portugal and Spain. So we broke Napoleon's codes. He didn't break ours. And furthermore, he had no idea that there was a Napoleonic ultra secret. His best code, and there's a picture of it in the book, was broken by a British codebreaker who became the first British codebreaker to get a knighthood.
As you mentioned earlier, a lot of the way that we think about spies is shaped by fiction. And one of those things is technology. So, of course, we think of invisible cars and exploding pens and invisible ink. But in terms of real life technology, what have been some of the key developments that have facilitated the improvement in intelligence?
Well, if I had to pick out one, it would be what is called imagery intelligence, the ability to see the world from above. You know, arguably, the reason that we're able to have this conversation now is because of the role of imagery intelligence in the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, which I don't think there's any doubt was the most dangerous moment in the history of the world. Soviet Russia and the United States were squaring up to each other after the Russians secretly put nuclear missile bases into Cuba. And if there had been a Third World War, it would have been a nuclear Third World War, and a lot of the world would not have survived. So why doesn't it happen? Well, I think the main reason is that the Americans discover in advance what is happening before the missile bases are actually ready. And they do that from spy planes, which can operate at 70,000 feet, which it was only just beginning to be possible to shoot them down at. Later on, of course, it was spy satellites. And the discovery that the bases are being built before they were operational gives time to negotiate a settlement, which, put it at its most straightforward, saves the world. So in 1962, October 1962, secret intelligence helped save the world.
In the end of the book, you bring things up to up to the 21st century, which you could argue we're seeing the world change quicker than it's ever changed before in terms of the technological revolution that's happening at the moment. I wondered if you could just speak a bit about how you think the age of the internet has transformed intelligence and what we might see in the future.
Well, I think in many ways the age of the internet has made less difference to the way that governments use intelligence because, you know, when these things began, they were government monopolies, just as nowadays everybody on Google Earth can get a better picture of Cuba than was available to the most advanced intelligence systems in 1962. So the difficulty now is coping with how people who represent a threat to us, either at the international level or at the terrorist level, are using a new technology. But it does mean that we understand the most dangerous people in the world in a way that we didn't before. Now, I think one striking example is North Korea, which presents the most extraordinary dilemma, because what is being done in North Korea at the moment, the worst gulags since the Nazi death camps of the Second World War, and yet at the same time, it has or potentially has nuclear weapons. That's a real threat to deal with. But it does mean that powers cannot nowadays conceal even from the media things that they could conceal from the greatest powers in the world earlier in the 20th century. For example, we now know more about the gulag in Kim Jong-un's North Korea than we ever did about Stalin's gulag at the height of the Great Terror in 1936 to 1938. We are now at a stage when terrorist groups are beginning to get hold of means of destruction and means of communication, which a generation ago were a state monopoly. So, you know, I stick to one of the points that I've made at the end of the book. It's not a question of if, it's merely a question of when terrorist groups start using weapons of mass destruction.
So in conclusion, if you wanted readers to take something away from your book, what would it be?
What I hope they would take away from the book is that secret intelligence is a necessary part of the history of the world. And there are many good histories of the world, but if they leave out intelligence, they have left out something of real importance. Secondly, that we have a false view of what intelligence has achieved in the past, for I think a couple of reasons. One is it's been left out of many histories. There are not many, for example, that say that it was at least as important under Queen Elizabeth I as it was under Queen Elizabeth the Second. And the second is that because of ignorance of past experience, more I would have said than in any other area of human activity, you do from time to time find people who are not nearly as good at using it as their predecessors over 100 years before.
That was Christopher Andrew. The Secret World, A History of Intelligence, is out now in the UK, published by Alan Lane. And in the US, it's due to be published by Yale in September. And if you'd like to read more about the history of intelligence, then you might like to check out our special edition entitled The Secret History of Spies. You can order a copy from buysubscriptions.com/spies. And we've now come to the end of today's episode. But please do listen in on Thursday, when we're going to be exploring the history of refugees.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.